Peter Singer once said, "From an ethical point of view, we all stand on equal footing, whether we stand on 2 feet or four or none at all." Welcome to episode 36 of Our Hen House, a place to find our way to change the world for animals. In today's episode, we'll give you the lowdown on why I was telling a theater full of perfect strangers all about my adolescent secrets. We'll discuss Lady Gaga's recent venture to the dark side and how some animal activists are fighting back. And we'll tell you about a protest that I filmed for PETA earlier this week. Joining us today is the illustrious Peter Singer, of no relation to me, by the way. Peter, who is perhaps the greatest philosopher of our time, will give us his thoughts on why animals are important, how he feels about rights for certain species, such as the great ape protections in Spain, and how he feels about in vitro meat. You absolutely won't want to miss this exclusive interview with the man who shaped the animal rights movement as we know it. For the unscientific, unofficial Facebook survey portion of our show, we'll be begging the question, what do you think is the most effective tool for inspiring people to go vegan? The results may surprise you. They sure surprised me. All that, some vegan banter, and of course, tons of current events from the world of animal rights.
Amazing.
My name is Jasmine Singer, and I'll be your co-host today in our hen house, along with my darling, Marianne Sullivan.
Incredible.
Now please, pull up some hay. Let's get squawking. I'd like to welcome my co-host, Marianne Sullivan.
Hello, my little star.
Well, thank you.
You're the star of the show.
And you're talking about mortified, I assume?
Yes, you were the most mortified person up there.
Mortified is a show that I co-produce here in New York City, and it's basically a comic excavation where people go up on stage and read their adolescent journals to hundreds of strangers, and I've done it for a couple years now, and we do it every couple months, and it never ceases to baffle me that I can be on stage and just tell perfect strangers about things like my love affair in my head with Bette Midler, or the piece I did earlier this week, a piece about the complex about my breasts.
Yes, you had quite a burdensome relationship with your breasts when you were a teenager, didn't you?
Can you ever imagine going up on stage at Mortified?
No, that's really not me.
I guess not, but...
Yeah, you're the performer, honey.
Well, it was a fun time. It really was. The crowd...
No, you were great. You were very funny.
Oh, well, thank you.
But that guy with the gnomes, he was the funniest.
There was a guy who was gnome-obsessed as a child, which was pretty funny. I didn't feel great about my performance, but...
No, you were really good.
Thank you. I appreciate that. It's been a busy week. Lady Gaga wore lots of dead animals to the MTV Music Video Awards.
Yeah, it was all an interesting phenomenon, wasn't it? People were so horrified. And right. It was pretty disgusting, I have to say. God.
And her whole point
She's such a strange one.
Her whole point was that she didn't want gay people to be treated like a piece of meat. It was supposed to be an activist thing. It's funny how she oppresses one group in order to enlighten people or attempt to enlighten people about the other group.
I don't even understand that. Like, who was she protesting against?
Somebody sent me a video of Lady Gaga on Ellen, who, of course, is like one of our favorite, you know, people on Earth, obviously. And she came on to Ellen's show wearing the meat dress, and Ellen wouldn't hug her. I mean, I heard people say things like, oh, Ellen's a sellout for having her on. But she did give her a bikini made out of kale.
Oh, that was funny.
It was cute, yeah. But, so...
Well, I think the whole thing's just kind of ironic that everybody got... I mean, that everybody's making such a big deal. Well, of course, it's a big deal because it's Lady Gaga and she's so crazy famous. I think that so many people, particularly non-vegans, are so disgusted by it. They put this stuff in their bodies. They eat it. And they wear leather. I mean, as Ari Solomon pointed out in his piece in Huffington Post. And they use animals in all sorts of ways. Why is this particular way so particularly disgusting? I guess it just highlighted how disgusting it all is. And it must have smelled like hell.
I'm sure. Totally disgusting. And as you said, Ari put something on the Huffington Post. Ari, who is an incredible activist and the founder of A Scent of Scandal Candles.
And a member of our advisory board.
And a member of our advisory board. An all-around great guy. And Nathan Runkel from Mercy for Animals published an open letter to Lady Gaga that made the connections between, you know, gay rights and animal rights. So there are activist opportunities to be had here. People just need to seize them.
Oh, I think this is a huge activist opportunity because everybody, I mean, it was a big deal. Everybody was talking about it. Everybody knew about it. It's kind of just kind of one of those topics that everybody wants to talk about and offer their own opinion about it. Right. And when those topics come up and they have anything to do with animals, you got to grab them.
On the complete change of topic, the absolute opposite of what Lady Gag did, I filmed a PETA protest the other day.
You're becoming quite the videographer.
I filmed a PETA protest. It was for Fashion Week, and they were trying to show that fur is not fashionable, which, of course, it's not. It's the product of anally or vaginally electrocuted animals. And five women were pretty much naked. They were wearing underwear, and they had pasties over their breasts, their nipples. So they were painted like tigers and leopards, and they were holding signs saying that animals' skin is not our skin. And it was, you know, a PETA protest.
Yeah, it sounds like classic PETA.
So, what do you think about the whole women being naked thing?
It's never bothered me.
Yeah, I mean, I feel really, really split about it.
I like naked women myself.
Really? Should I worry? I feel split about it, to be honest. Because sometimes I, you know, feel like it's just complete womanizing and all that. Like, we don't need to be saving animals by exploiting our bodies. But on the other hand, the women are over 18 and they're making the decisions for themselves, and if it's going to help animals, then fine. So I really feel split about it. I'm sure I just pissed a lot of people off and they're annoyed at me because a lot of people feel one way or the other, and I don't know the answer, but I did film it because they needed someone to film it, and I dropped it off at CNN. It would be nice if CNN aired it.
I guess there's, you know, people feel very strongly about the objectification of the female. But I just don't, you know, I just don't care about that stuff. What can I say? I'm a one-trick pony.
You're actually naked right now and painted like a leopard.
So what's the big deal?
You always dress up for our podcast. I'm falling off my chair. We have Peter Singer on our show today.
I know. I think that what will we do from here on in?
Ellen?
Yeah.
Yeah, Ellen's next. It goes Peter Singer, Ellen.
Well, Ellen better get, like, on the phone.
Ellen, if you're listening, which I'm sure you are.
You were apparently on our podcast.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm pretty excited.
I'm kind of terrified. Is that weird?
Yeah, no, he's a scary guy. He's scary smart.
I'm interested in talking to Peter. And enough with this nonsense about PETA. Let's talk to PETA. Peter Singer was born in Melbourne, Australia in 1946 and educated at the University of Melbourne and the University of Oxford. He has taught at the University of Oxford, La Trobe University, and Monash University. Since 1999, he has been Ira W. DeCamp Professor of Bioethics in the University Center for Human Values at Princeton University. From 2005, he has also held the part-time position of Laureate Professor at the University of Melbourne in the Center for Applied Philosophy and Public Ethics. Peter Singer first became well known internationally after the publication of Animal Liberation in 1975. Since then, he has written many other books, including Practical Ethics, The Expanding Circle, How Are We to Live, The Ethics of What We Eat with Jim Mason, and most recently, The Life You Can Save. In 2005, Time magazine voted him one of the top 100 people who shape our lives. He is married with three daughters and three grandchildren. His recreations, apart from reading and writing, include hiking and surfing. Welcome to our hen house, Peter Singer.
Hi, it's good to be with you.
We're excited to have you, the grandfather of animal rights in so many ways.
Well, grandfather is a little cold.
I mean that in the best possible way. So let's just get right into this. Peter, why do you consider animals important?
Animals are important because they can feel things. They have mental lives. They can enjoy their lives or they can have miserable lives. And that will often depend on what we do to them and how we treat them. So I think any being who has the capacity to feel something, to have experiences, those experiences matter. It's not relevant whether they're humans or members of our species in itself. What's important is what it's like for them to be living and what difference we can make to that.
I know that one of the big problems that people confront is that the word animals is such a broad term and means such a huge variety of different species. Do you think the science currently is good enough to let us know how we should treat various animals? And if it isn't, what we should do in the face of our lack of knowledge of what's going on inside them?
Well, the science is perfectly good as far as birds and mammals are concerned. In fact, I'd go further and say it's very strong as far as vertebrates are concerned. That is, that all vertebrate animals are capable of feeling pain and capable of being conscious. And while, of course, there's more that science can do in terms of the detail of this, that is, what kinds of living conditions animals might prefer or not prefer, there's still a lot to learn about that. But you know, that these that vertebrate animals are beings whose interests we should take into account, I think the science is very clear about. When we get down to invertebrates, there's more we could know, and there's room for doubt, and some of that doubt is going to be very difficult to resolve. So I think we really need to look at the evidence for each different species, even just when talking about invertebrates. There's huge amounts of differences between say, an octopus, which is clearly capable of learning things, of finding novel solutions to problems, like getting food out of a screw-top jar. And on the other hand, you've got perhaps an oyster, which doesn't seem really capable of learning anything and may not really be a conscious being at all. So you've got to look at the particular case in order to decide how we ought to treat that being, how we ought to respond to that being's potential to have interests.
So when we do have some idea of what interests they have besides just not suffering, what interests should be protected? How do we figure that out?
That all relates to what will make that being's life go well or badly. And I think in general, we should try to make the lives of other beings go as well as possible, but of course sometimes there are going to be difficult conflicts with our own interests. Those conflicts might be if we have no other way of feeding ourselves. So while I think it's easy enough for people in the United States generally to be vegetarian or vegan because they have alternatives, putting aside perhaps a very small number of people with health conditions that make that difficult. But on the other hand, in developing countries where people might need to get all the food they can to get enough food for their families, or on the other hand, where they're in a part of the world where they can't really grow plant foods and therefore they rely on grazing animals, then obviously you do have conflicts between human interests and animal interests, and you have to try and reach a solution that does least harm to all of them put together, and that's obviously a difficult thing to work out.
Yeah, it really is. And it, you know, when I teach animal law, I teach the cruelty law, and it seems like the basic cruelty law that most countries have and that every state here has basically expresses exactly that concept. They really have a utilitarian perspective, prohibiting causing animals suffering unless it's necessary or justifiable. And that's a pretty high standard, necessary. But then, like, they just don't work. Very little of what we do to animals is necessary. Do you have any idea why these laws don't work, even though they do express a really good goal?
I think the law has taken this term necessary to really mean for any legitimate human purpose. So if you try and say, well, it's cruel to keep hens in battery cages and that's not necessary, of course, it's not necessary because, firstly, we don't even really need to eat eggs in the United States. At least we have alternatives. And secondly, if we did need to eat eggs, we could produce them at just a marginally greater cost by having them not in cages. But the courts, as I understand it, tend to interpret that necessary as necessary for the purpose of, you know, putting eggs to market at the lowest possible price. And so they won't see the battery cage as unnecessary cruelty. On the other hand, if somebody stands out in Main Street hitting a dog with a stick, then probably they will get charged with unnecessary cruelty, because that's something that most people have no interest in. But since people have an interest in getting their eggs cheaply, the courts will not put a stop to that kind of practice, to the battery cage practice.
Yeah, exactly. Actually, the courts don't even really very much have a chance to even look at it, only occasionally. But I worry about whether their ineffectiveness means that a cost-benefit approach can't work. Can we have a cost-benefit approach where we spell it out very specifically? Does that comport with how you would want to see the laws written?
Yeah, I think we need to distinguish between what is ultimately the ethical test of whether a practice is legitimate or not. And I do think that that is a cost-benefit approach, as long as we are talking about the costs and benefits for animals as well as for humans, and we're giving full weight to the costs for animals. But if you say, what should the law be? Well, the law, generally speaking, doesn't take a cost-benefit approach on most cases. I mean, the classic examples, I guess, would be where somebody kills her husband or because he's dying and got dementia and has said to her many times, I don't want to live with dementia. So carrying out that request, she kills him. Now, if she then gets charged with murder, the court is not going to say, well, there was no costs here because he didn't want to go on living and his quality of life was such that he did not want it, and actually he was a burden on the wife who killed him, and therefore she should be acquitted because she did something that has benefits and no costs. So the law doesn't take that stance. The law just says, well, you must not kill an innocent human being, that's murder, and therefore you're guilty of murder. The sentence obviously might reflect the circumstances to some extent. But so given that generally the law doesn't try to do those cost-benefit calculations, I think you could easily argue that it should not do them in the case of animal cruelty either. It should set standards which are clear and which everybody can understand, and the standards themselves might have a cost-benefit rationale for humans and animals, but the law should be one that doesn't actually get into that level of detail.
Mm. And how do you feel about attempts to achieve human-like rights for certain species, such as the great ape protections in Spain?
Well, I've supported that move largely because I think it will be helpful if we can break down the barrier between humans and non-human animals. So taking the great apes as our closest relatives and the beings who we can empathize with best, perhaps they're most like us in various ways, plus the fact that we don't eat them, so we don't have large vested interests in rearing them and killing them, makes them a good candidate to say, let's try to grant human-like rights to great apes, and let's use this as a bridge to other species, so that once it's established that great apes have them, we can perhaps start to move forward and say, well, what about some other animals as well?
Do you think that there's a philosophical grounding for giving any animals a right to life, as opposed to just a right not to experience any kind of negative experiences?
Well, I think if we want to use the language of rights, then we should ask, why do we think that humans have rights to life? And my answer to that is something to do with the fact that we are very much future-oriented beings. We are capable of having plans and hopes for the future, and that to kill us when we want to go on living is to deprive us of the possibility of fulfilling those hopes and wishes. So if that's what's special about human beings and why we think that human beings might have a right to life, say snails don't have, then we need to ask whether some non-human animals might also have those kinds of capacities. And again, the great apes will be the clearest examples for animals that are future-directed in that way, although they are not going to be the only examples.
I've just always wanted to ask you this question, even though it's probably we're probably going far afield, but as long as I have you here, I'm going to ask you. What about with thinking about a right to life? Not that the animal themselves have a right to life, but whether they're friends, relatives, loved ones, people, or other animals who live with them would suffer because they lost their life. Would that enter into the calculation?
Yes, it would. I mean, I think that's a major aspect of what's so wrong about killing human beings normally, too, that you inflict a huge loss on their family and friends and loved ones. So that's going to be true for some animals, but what we need to think about, of course, is for which species is that true? Because you do get a lot of variation there. You get some species that live mostly isolated lives, where they will come together with an animal of their species to mate, and then the female will bring up the offspring. But after that, once that's over, they'll be isolated again. So you could say for some species there isn't going to be that sense of grief, and maybe even for some herd animals there isn't either. That's, I think, still in doubt, and there's research ongoing into that extent. I've certainly been told by people who have sheep, for example, that they don't really notice if you remove one of the flock, but I'm not sure whether that's true or whether that's a sort of self-interested perception. On the other hand, with others, certainly, with the great apes, it does seem, well, when I say with the great apes, with chimpanzees, orangutans, and bonobos, I think orangutans tend to be, chimpanzees, gorillas, and is that what I said, bonobos? Because orangutans tend to be more solitary. But, there seems to be grief at the loss of those who are close to them.
So what do you feel are the most important issues facing people who care about animals?
I think that people who care about animals should always be focused on where can they do the most to have the most impact on reducing the amount of pain and suffering out there. And I focus on pain and suffering. It's not the only thing that counts, but it's often the most severe, and it's the thing where you can be clearest that you're making a difference. So, that's the question I would ask. And obviously, you're going to look at practices then, firstly, that you can affect, that you can have an impact on, and secondly, that involve a large number of animals. So that's why I say, if you're in the United States, for instance, I think what affects the most animals is clearly factory farming, affects them most severely, and that's something that you can have an impact on, because there has been a significant movement to turn people away from factory farming, to develop alternatives, to cut back on the worst forms of confinement, like the battery cage and the gestation crates for sows and veal calves. So I think, those are the sorts of questions you ought to be asking. And although you might, for instance, see some awful cruelty in a video taken in China, or you might be horrified by bullfighting in Spain, it's probably not a lot you can do about that. It might be worth writing a letter or two to somewhere, but it's going to be much harder to have an impact on that than it is on something in your own country where this is going on right where you are, or the products of factory farming are being sold in a supermarket near you. You can contact your legislators, of course. I think we ought to stick to those areas where we can have a direct impact.
How do you feel about in vitro meat?
I think in vitro meat would be great if it can be brought to the market in a environmentally sustainable and cost-effective way. At the moment, it seems like it's still some years off before that could happen. But if it does happen, and if it produces something that is at the molecular level identical to meat and tastes as good as meat to people, I think that could be the ultimate solution to the problems that we have with the meat industry.
Yeah, absolutely. I sometimes feel that everything we do is kind of a holding action until they get in vitro meat on board. I just hope it happens. So Australia and the U.S., you've been recently spending time back home in Australia, and of course you live in the U.S. now. They're fairly similar cultures on a lot of these issues. Who do you think is ahead?
That's not easy to say. I mean, it does depend a little bit on the issue. I think if you look at the use of animals in experimentation, probably Australia is ahead there because there was less polarization between the scientists and the animal movement, and some scientists got together and said, well, we need to have regulations to stop bad things happening, which won't be good for science as a whole. So they invited members of the animal movement to join committees to draw up codes, and I think, you know, they're obviously not perfect, they're a compromise like anything in this area. We have reasonably good regulations there. On the other hand, Australia hasn't made much progress with farm animals as yet, perhaps because the rural political lobby has been important in Australia, even more so than in the United States. It's also very important here too. And also we don't have this initiative system, this referendum system that was effective in California in getting the law, the referendum passed in 2008, Proposition 2, to effectively phase out the standard battery cage and the gestation crates for sows and the veal crates. We don't have that possibility in Australia, so we haven't yet seen any states banning any of these forms of factory farming, although we've had a little bit of talk from some of the state governments saying that they're thinking of doing this, but so far, no action.
Well, I do hear hope coming from you, at least for the U.S. I agree with you that in vitro meat might be our only chance. And certainly since Animal Liberation was written, really a lot has happened in the world of farm animals, probably because Animal Liberation was written. So we thank you so much for coming and joining us today in our hen house and for talking to us a bit.
And I have to say, vis-a-vis Animal Liberation, I know you've heard a million times from a million people, oh my God, that book changed my life. But I'll tell you, I teach animal law, and every single semester, students in my class say they read Animal Liberation, and that's why they're taking the course.
Well, that's fantastic. I'm always glad that the book keeps on working. But when you give it credit for the change that it happened, I mean, there have been literally millions of hardworking animal activists who've made those changes happen, and you know, I don't want to take any credit away from them. It's been a tremendous effort and a real voluntary, altruistic effort, and I think it's something that you know, can really make us feel good. One of the good sides of human nature is that people are prepared to work altruistically for animals.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Peter.
Thanks very much, Jasmine and Marianne. Good to talk to you both.
Well, that was definitely a treat to have Peter Singer join us here in our hen house. We're quelling! We are. And with that, let's get right into some news, shall we? So what's going on in the European Union?
Yeah, the EU tightened up its animal testing rules a bit. This has been a long time coming. They've been negotiating this for a long time. I think there have been some progressive moves made, and unfortunately I think that it's kind of a disappointment to animal welfare advocates who expected to get a lot more. The big thing is that now animal testing on the great apes will be banned, and actually they haven't been doing that in the EU, anywhere in the EU, for quite a while, but it hasn't been against the law, and it will be. And they've put in a lot of protections that are not that dissimilar from protections provided by the American Animal Welfare Act, which have not existed in all EU countries. I mean, that's the significant thing, that some countries have had very strong protections for a long time, but many of them have not. So this has really improved the regulation in a lot of countries, but as anything, it all depends on the enforcement. So we'll see. I know that it was not everything people hoped it would be, and the biomedical industry seems to be pretty pleased, so that's not a good sign. And then meanwhile, back in the USSR, or I should say in the USA, we're going backwards instead of forwards. There's a huge controversy going on about some chimpanzees out at Holloman Air Force Base. These are chimps. I mean, these used to be Coolston chimps. I don't know how many of you remember,
back when probably the most evil lab run by the monstrosity, Dr. Frederick Coulston, had charge of all of these chimpanzees who had been originally bred for the space program and weren't used. And he used them for, you know, to test oven cleaner and everything else and kept them in horrible conditions. And there was huge controversy about it. And when they passed that law several years ago to retire the chimpanzees, it had the loophole, which many people were worried about at the time, that allowed the chimps possibly to go back into research someday, and that seems to be what's happening. Some of them have gone to sanctuary in Florida and I think other places, but some of them still remain in New Mexico at Holloman Air Force Base, and they're trying to get them back into research, and it's just a tragedy. And where other countries are moving forward on banning experimentation on these kinds of animals, we're going backwards.
It's a travesty. Switching gears for a minute, it is back to school time, which can be difficult for kids, for parents, and for dogs and cats. The New York Times had an article called "Your Pet's Back to School Blues" that talked about that.
Yeah, I love that they published this. Well, it wasn't really an article. It was in the blog, the wellness blog. But still, that's a huge audience that reads that blog, I'm sure. And they were talking about they have a Well Pets division of that blog. And they're talking about the angst that animals suffer when the kids go back to school, something that people never think about. And they suggest a number of strategies for dealing with how stressful this is for the animals. And of course it is. I mean, you know, as we know, dogs are all about keeping the pack together. If when the children start leaving every day, that's just so stressful for them. They don't understand. And I just love that they did this article. And another thing I loved is they picked it up from the ASPCA. Great advocacy work on the ASPCA's part to get this picked up and written as a mainstream article, really worrying about the psychological welfare of animals.
And that was our news.
So we have another unscientific, unofficial Facebook survey, again through our Facebook page, which you should join if you're not yet a part of it. And the question was, what do you think is the most effective tool for inspiring people to go vegan? And the answers were surprising, I think.
Yeah, they are. This is always a significant question, and I'm damned if I know the answer.
So a few of the things that people mentioned were showing movies on AR issues, which is always great.
Well, it is great, but it's sometimes hard to get anybody to watch them who isn't already vegan. But if you can get that captive audience, maybe, in my opinion, the best.
And someone else mentioned peer pressure, which is an interesting tactic.
Well, we were talking last week about how much fun it is when there's one non-vegan and a bunch of vegans. Mm-hmm. And the problem is usually most of people's peers aren't vegan either. So unless they happen to be in a group of vegans.
Yeah, I'm not sure that's the best strategy. But hey, if it works for you personally.
Someday we'll get there.
And somebody else said one that I like, dating a non-vegan.
Oh, the sexual enticement route to advocacy.
And of course, you know, if you date a different person every day, you could potentially have a very strong impact, though. If you're only dating a few people a year, there might be ways to get more bang for your buck, so to speak. And there was also showing graphic images. A few people, more than one person, agreed with that, the importance of that. But that goes back to what you were just saying with the AR. Like, what are you going to do, just foist it upon them? I guess if you're doing a street demo with footage, you can foist it upon them. But
yeah, I have no problem with graphic images. Some people say it's ineffective. But the problem I have, is that it's hard to get anybody to watch them. I think they're actually very effective.
And that actually relates to undercover investigations, which a few people also agreed with. And I think that that is at the heart of our movement in so many ways, just the importance of getting that
out there. And when it's on the 10 o'clock news, you can't help but watch it. So groups like Mercy for Animals have obviously been doing wonderful things with having undercover investigations. And I wish that every activist and every activist group really was focusing on undercover investigations. I don't think it needs to be exclusive to MFA. I think that the more, and obviously Compassion Over Killing and HSUS also do undercover investigations, but there are a lot more out there, a lot more groups and activists. It'd be great.
Yeah, the more the better, because people still have the perception that they're going after the bad eggs, so to speak, and they're not. They're going after anybody they can find that they can get into, and it always turns out to be horrible. But I think people still lull themselves into the sense of complacency that, oh, they're not all like this, and this was just a particularly bad one that they found to do an undercover investigation. So the more there are, the more you can dispel that completely erroneous assumption.
Health benefits was another thing that people mentioned, is to talk about the health benefits, and I think that's great, but I tend to think that all of this really depends on your audience, so maybe it was an unfair question in a way, because the most effective tool for inspiring people to go vegan changes depending upon who you're talking to. If you're talking to someone who's health obsessed, then yeah, go the health route, or maybe even give them a copy of the China study. But if you're going the route of somebody who loves animals, you might prefer to show them a movie like Earthlings, or, you know, make them read a few pamphlets.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Different approaches obviously work for different people, so there's no one right answer to this question. But I think health benefits is going to become a bigger and bigger and bigger tool. With all these movies coming out this year, Forks Over Knives and Chowdown and lots more, people are just going to have to start becoming aware of what the standard American diet is doing to people, that it's a disaster, and that meat holds a very high place. It's certainly not the only problem, but it holds a very high place on the list of things that are really killing Americans. So I think that's going to become bigger and bigger.
It actually just occurred to me when I said show someone a pamphlet that nobody put good old grassroots tactics like leafleting and tabling, not one person.
Oh, that's really a shame, because I continue to think that leafleting is one of the most effective things that an individual can do, and have an enormous amount of admiration for vegan outreach. And leafleting is just the basis of their entire organization, and I think they've created an enormous amount of change.
Well, one thing that I think is the most effective way of helping people to go vegan is positive media, and nobody really agreed with me on that, so I don't know if I'm on my own here or not, but I think that especially in our country, media has such a, you know, inexplicable power. And look at what's happened just from the coverage of, you know, positive coverage of animal rights issues, that it's in the mainstream television. Look at what's happened with Ellen. Look at what happens when Jane Velez-Mitchell puts up an animal rights story. Look at what happens when, you know, Oprah does something. Of course, Oprah has her flaws, but she has gone vegan for, you know, a period of time, and educated people who never heard about the word vegan before about veganism. So just getting positive news stories up there and positive media, I think, is a huge asset. I'm surprised that I was alone on that.
Well, maybe people, I don't see how anybody could not think that was important. And I agree with you. It's the most important, arguably the only important thing. I mean, if we can't get positive media, we're not going to succeed here. But maybe if people just felt that that was not something they could accomplish, that they had no power over. And I think that's something to be addressed. I think everything we do on behalf of animals should be with some sort of an eye towards getting media.
Absolutely. Some other people said education, which is a little bit broad, but if you're talking humane education, which I don't think was what they were talking, but let's just go with that for a second. If you're talking humane education, then planting those seeds is obviously a very invaluable thing to do when you're trying to breed young, compassionate folks. Or old compassionate folks.
Yeah, I think that I'm not sure exactly what people meant by education. I think that teaching people about what's going on with animals is absolutely crucial. It's not going to change everybody, but we always have to remember that we don't have to change everybody. Once a certain percentage of people make this change, the rest of people will just follow, because that's the way change works.
That's a really important thing to remember. You always talk about 10%. Let's just get 10% of them on board, and the rest will come.
I really think that that's true. If I didn't, I'd have to hang myself.
Don't do that. It's true. The two top categories, the second to top category for that people voted for was food activism, which of course is, I agree with that, it's a great one.
Yeah, if we can't get delicious food into people's hands and make them understand that this food is delicious, we're lost. People are much too selfish to give up their taste buds for the animals.
And I would never have guessed this, but by a landslide, the category that most people agreed with was leading by example and having positive communication skills.
Well, I mean, I think those are important, but they're kind of just the basics.
Right.
It's what do you do after that? Like, it's kind of letting yourself off the
exactly.
hook.
Exactly. I'm glad you said that, because it kind of irked me in a way. I mean, obviously we need to lead by example. It's like, obviously we need to be vegan. Obviously we need to be, you know, sane, kind individuals. But the world does not have time for us to just be leading by example, and that's it. And I wonder if the fact that so many people, that resonated with them, is because that's the extent of activism for so many people.
Well, I wouldn't go that far. It might just be that people think that's the bottom line. That's the thing that everybody has to do, and then activism comes on top of that. But it's certainly true that if your example isn't good and you're not communicating in a positive way, nothing else you do is going to be worth it. But yeah, I agree with you. That certainly can't be all you do. That's deluding ourselves to think that we can change the world just by our example. Nobody really gives a shit what we do.
Yeah, it's the animals are dying by the billions, and it's just not enough for us to just have a vegan cupcake for dessert. It's just not. I'm not trying to be a bitch. I think I sound like I'm being a bitch.
Yeah, well, it happens.
Well, on that note,
revealing it to the world, Jasmine is occasionally a bitch.
And on that note, are we done calling me a bitch, or should we do it one more time just for the hell of it?
She's not really a bitch. She just acts like she is.
That was our show for today. Thank you so much for joining us. And please join us on October 1st, which is really, really soon now, at our launch.
Or Jasmine will come and beat you up.
That is not true. I practice nonviolence. Ahimsa. I have it tattooed across my ankle, but I will be sad if you don't go, if it's at all possible. If you're in, like, you know, Australia, I realize it would be a long trip.
It's not that long.
Well, thank you for joining us today. If you like what you're hearing, please consider making a donation. We are a 501c3 organization, and we make it super easy for you to make a donation, either one time or recurring, on our website, ourhenhouse.org. I do want to add that everything that we talk about on our news section, there's a link to that article on the blog that corresponds with this podcast. We do that every week. So definitely check that out. Please follow us on Facebook and Twitter and all that fun stuff. If you would like to contact us, do so at info@ourhenhouse.org. Let us know what the story is. And thank you so much for joining us today. We look forward to seeing what the deal is next week. That's all for me. Is that all for you?
I'm out.
Ciao.